And so continuing with our journey through Jewish law, so we went kind of quickly, but we got to see an overview from Har Sinai to the redaction of the Talmud and saw how and why the Talmud became authoritative. And then through the various efforts, significant efforts and contributions towards codifying law, meaning to so that people would more easily be able to open up a book and be able to see what to do. And I didn't mention last time, but we'll note that even though it seemed that probably a century or two, certainly I think by two centuries after the Shulchan Aruch was published, it became basically universally accepted. At the time, there were some criticisms about the idea of being able to kind of look things up, because obviously when you see things that are abridged in that way, you don't get the full context, and which is why there are commentaries in the Shulchan Aruch, and in order to properly understand even a practical halachic issue, it's necessary to see the Gemara and other Rishonim for a full analysis of the issue. So there were some controversies surrounding that, but for the most part, a century or certainly like two centuries afterwards, there was acceptance of the Shulchan Aruch. But it didn't all end with the Shulchan Aruch. You mind, the Rambam thought that they would end with him, that after the publishing of the Mishneh Torah, he'd be able to look things up and whatever he meant by that, not necessarily to have to look at other sources. All right, I'll just put in the chat a link to the sheet that I'm using. So this didn't end with the Shulchan Aruch, but even in particular, in the more immediate aftermath of the publishing of the Shulchan Aruch, so there was still, even though the work itself was accepted and its authority was accepted, there was still some disagreements. And we even see in halacha, as a general principle, we go according to the Shulchan Aruch, but there are some times where at least the early Achronim, namely the Shach, Taz, and Magen Avram, in particular, may present an opinion, or hold like an opinion, that may differ from the Shulchan Aruch. But in addition to the contributions of these, call it early Achronim, these early commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, which we call generally the Nosei Kelim, the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, they appear on the page of your standard Shulchan Aruch, and they analyzed the issues, and they presented some of their own issues, and they became particularly impactful in how we practice afterwards. But what's fascinating about each of these three, known by their works, the Shach, the Taz, and the Magen Avram, is, in addition to their contributions, just the world in which they live, their interactions with each other, are really fascinating. And like we mentioned at the beginning, it's something to appreciate, not only the Torah that was left, but the circumstances under which this Torah was learned and when was written down. So in the era of particularly the Shach and the Taz in Eastern Europe, it was probably, talking about the best of times, the worst of times, it's probably the worst period in Jewish history, maybe between the destruction of the Second Beis Hamikdash and the Holocaust. There was the massacre of Tachvetat, referring to the year that this happened, which is in the secular calendar, 1648 to 1649, which is with the infamous Kalmitsky massacres. And the background of that is, in Eastern Europe, the different the countries were fighting with each other. At that time, it was common to have conflicts over religious belief. And you had that with the Hundred Years' War, with the French and then the British, Catholicism and Protestantism. And in the East, you had that with basically the Polish Catholics and the Russian or Ukrainian population of the Russian Orthodox Church, Russian Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox Church, and they were at war with each other. They were fighting with each other, but what they could both agree upon, which is usually how it is they all hated the Jews. That everyone can agree upon. And basically what was going on then is there was, says in the summary, and I have to credit Rabbi Anthony Manning, he's an educator in Eretz Yisrael, he has a fabulous summary and background of these people, these issues. And so you basically had the Poles versus the Ukrainians, and you know, eventually there was some sort of treaty that largely based on the fact that they all hated the Jews for, you know, other reasons, but including the fact that the Jews were often tax collectors and money lenders because the Christians weren't allowed to enter those professions. And in 1648, Bogdan Khmelnytsky, so he made an alliance with the Tartars in Crimea and swept across the Ukraine. And this was a terrible, terrible pogrom. In a short period of time, they went into Vilna, 45,000 people were killed. Basically, all in all, there were roughly 100,000 Jews who were murdered. Communities were destroyed. People were displaced. And keep in mind, this was before, you know, modern warfare. This is really all, you know, person-to-person combat. I mean, it was really a terrible, terrible time. And even though what's going on in the Ukraine now, what Russia is doing to the Ukraine, like, has any justification, but full stop. But if you do look at the history of the Ukrainians, and even more recently, but I mean, it was really vicious what the extent that they went to totally massacre Jews. And actually, I think in Kiev there's still a statue of Khmelnytsky, so I don't know. But unfortunately, it was embedded. But at that time, it was probably the worst period, one of the worst periods in Jewish history. And at this time, give me 1 second. Okay. And at this time, there was some movement in Europe. Jews started going a little back to Western Europe or to Central Europe. And also, maybe we hadn't planned to take a look at it, but maybe it might be worthwhile to take a look at the Sabbatean movement, because partly, I think, as an outgrowth of these desperate times, there was a notion that we are at the footsteps of Mashiach, and there was that the times were really desperate. But what's amazing is, I think, all of these contributions to Torah were developed or written in this time period. But just to give some context about the world that Shach Taz and Magen Avraham lived in, things were never so great for Jews, but in Europe. But this was really the worst of times. And Rabbi Manning presented the thesis, which I think is compelling, that as communities were displaced and were really decimated, that was part of the catalyst of why the Shulchan Aruch was more universally accepted. I think we see that a little bit more recently, is that to a large extent, communities function in, academics call it mimetic tradition, meaning it's according to halacha, but it's not necessarily that that it's codified in a book. It's more what communities did, what Rabbanim held, and the local custom. But as communities had to move and there was less of an ability to transmit that and maintain that, that may have been part of the catalyst of why the Jewish community on a whole accepted the Shulchan Aruch. Also happened to be the Shulchan Aruch was written shortly after the printing press was developed. So maybe a little siyata d'shmaya there. I say that more recently is it's probably also a large reason why the Mishneh Berurah post-World War II in particular was accepted by Ashkenazi, at least a non-Hasidic Ashkenazi population. It happens to me, the Mishnah Berurah, there's a Sefer I saw in Minhagi Litta, and in Lithuania, not everyone practiced necessarily according to the Mishnah Berurah. But you know, as the tradition was interrupted a little bit, so sometimes you did have texts that became more prominent. One second. So now we get to the Taz. The Taz is the oldest of the three who we're going to discuss, which between the Shach and the Taz in particular creates a little bit of tension, because the Taz was 36 years older than the Shach. So the Taz, Reb David Halevi Siegel, was born in 1586 in Ludmir, Poland, and his grandfather was a colleague of the Ramah, and he was the son-in-law of Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, who is known as the Bach, the Bias Chadash. He's one of the main commentaries, one of the two main commentaries on the Torah. And so he was the son-in-law of the Bach. And apparently there's a legend that he went to, when the young Taz, or young David Halevi Siegel, went to talk and learning with the Bach, Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, and his daughter apparently said something that the Bach, her father, found very, very impressive. And he said, what you're saying is like the Levana. So apparently the Taz said, well, maybe now it's time to make Kiddush Levana. So they, to be Makadesh, that's a legend. But anyway, they married, and the Taz is a son-in-law of the Bach. And in addition to just the desperate situations in the Jewish world at the time, and particularly in the place where the Taz lived, in Poland, in the Taz's own life, he had to deal with tragedy. Some of his family were affected by the pogroms, but he sadly, two of his children died in a tragic accident. When they lived in an attic above a shul, and the roof collapsed. Now, some of these biographical information is known, are inserted in the Taz's writings. Now, to say why is it called the Taz? The Taz is called the Turei Zahav, and it's a play on words, because really, it's with a tuff, but it changes to the Turei Zahav is basically to show deference to the tour. It's the authority of the Torah. And because his father-in-law was one of the main commentaries on the Torah. But you see some of this biographical information in his writings themselves. And Taz is the commentary on Shulchan Aruch, and it's one of the two main commentaries on the Orach Chaim section and then Yoredeya. On Orach Chaim, the two main commentaries are the Taz and the Magen Avram, and on Yoredeya, it's the Shach and the Taz. So in the halachos of in Hilchos Beis HaKnesses, in the halachos of building a shul, so there's a halacha that you shouldn't live above a shul, or you shouldn't use the area above a shul for mundane or disrespectful purposes. Could be an exception if you're the shamish or someone who works for the shul, but there is a halacha you're not supposed to live above a shul. But the Taz writes, after in number one, after the three dots, Anibi al Dusa, Hayisi Dar Bikila Kadosha Krakow, im the aim bene basi by basis Rashi Shahayo Lamala Besakna says that in my youth I lived with my family above the shul in Krakow. Then Nashti Harbe Bemisa Bonai with Lacey Bozer, that I was punished for this. He interpreted the terrible accident as a punishment for the fact that maybe he wasn't so careful about this halacha of not living above a shul. So you just see here in interspersed in his writing some of this biographical information and an expression of the difficulties that he was facing at the time. And there's a letter from the Bach, from Yoel Sirkis, the Taz's father-in-law, also acknowledging the desperate times, even the desperate financial situation. And he writes to him, and he says in number two, and I've seen your suffering, oh, it's sarli, and I'm very pained by, distressed by this. And I'm not able to learn Torah in tranquility, because I know that you're suffering. Knows that his son-in-law and his daughter were living in very desperate times. And I wish that I could help you, but I don't have the means to do so. So just a correspondence to, you know, note that they were living under very, very poor conditions. And then he, as the timeline continues, he became the Rav of the city in Posen, and then he moves to Ashtrog, and held the yeshiva in Ashtrog, and he began his work, the Turei Zahav, the Taz. And became recognized as one of the Gedolei Hador. And you see later on also that Ashtrog was then attacked in the Kazakh rebellion. And so then he fled there. And apparently the siege was broken by a dramatic thunderstorm, which confused and scared the attackers. And then his wanderings, he met the Shach. We'll see who the Shach is. Who's also was on the run because of the pogroms. And many of his psukim, as you see here, reflect some of the pressing issues of the time, either personal or communal. And one example of this is there is a case of a woman whose husband and baby boy were killed in the pogroms. And the husband, both of them were killed, and the husband had a brother. Now, in some cases, if they have no children, and there's a surviving brother, so then they have to, there's an obligation of Yibum. Nowadays, and even in those times, they only did Chalitza, which is a way to release from Yibum. But until you do Chalitza, if you're in that situation, let's say, the government, someone dies, a couple doesn't have children, and the husband dies, and then but he has a surviving brother, so before the wife can remarry, they have to do this process of chalitza. And in some cases, even if there is a child that was born, if it's, you know, unviable, then there's a question. Even if there was a child born, so this case was that their son and the father were apparently killed on the same day, and the case was that if the son had died, if the baby had died before the father was killed, then potentially she'd have to do Yibum, or have to do Chalitza, and the surviving brother was on the other side of the world. So basically she would have been an Aguna. It's not the type of Aguna that we're so used to, though it is a real, it is a real issue. There are Chalitzas, it's definitely done. But there's a halacha that basically, if you're on the sidelines of war and people are getting, you know, killed all over the place, so then a person has credibility to testify that they saw someone was killed. So the woman, basically, she was one witness, but she testified that she was aware, saw that her husband had been killed before her son. And the halacha is, if you're in a war zone, then that claim would have credibility. And it would have validity, and she would not have to do Yibum or Chalitza. And the Taz says in number four that in our times, Vaday Gam Nitalim Ubayim Samoch Lemilchama, Gam Kim Besachana, Kashir Shamanu, Babanesena Arabi, Mechamosh, Jubagzeros, Hairos, Minigzera Takutat. So nowadays, where we find ourselves basically in a constant war zone, so Ein Chiluk, the call me. That in my humble opinion, even though true, not everyone is actually involved in war, but we're in these situations of the pogroms, so basically everyone would be considered in a war zone. So just another one of his psukim that reflected the desperate situation at the time. Another reflection of the time, you go into number six, and this is actually reflected in the postgame mentioned in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, which is in the mid-1800s, that On Pesach, there's a preference, strictly speaking, there's a preference for using red wine. But starting with the Taz, there was this recommendation not to use red wine, to use white wine. Why? The Taz says, number six, about Idda, that nowadays, Nimnu Amilich HaKiayin Adam, that now we're prevented, we should refrain from buying red wine, Yuvnei Alila Shekarim Vodaseinu Arabim, because of the blood libels. Now, this was something that, you know, wasn't theoretical, wasn't historical. And I think there was actually a big gap between different blood libels. There was one in England centuries earlier. They weren't constant. So you think you come to a point where, you know, it was ancient history when they had the blood libels. But then they do keep on recurring. So because of that, and since even reflected in the postgame in the mid-1800s, not to use red wine because you don't want to arouse the suspicion or accusations of the nations of the world. And also in number eight, partly because of the desperate situation of the time, that if there is a Jew, there's a prohibition of Masira, of handing over a Jew to a non-Jewish government, particularly one that doesn't have set laws. But if there's someone who's engaged in illegal activities and is going to result in harm for the whole community, so then the Taz, in number eight, permits handing over a Jew even to the non-Jewish authorities. He also tells a little bit of a biographical story in number nine, a little bit lighter than some of the other issues that he discussed, that there's a halacha, what do you do if you think that something is, let's say you mix up whether something is wine or beer, wine or water, you know, does the bracha still count, let's say on the wine? So he had a case where he was apparently making kiddush, said Borei Pri HaGafen, and he realized that he hadn't poured the wine, or the cup was empty. So, right. So he said, can you opinion? And he applies that. Well, maybe if there's wine at the table, so then, you know, there's a wine currently on the table, so then you can rely on that. Just a little, another autobiographical sketch that's found in his writings, and a little bit lighter than some of the other issues. And also, we see then later on in his life, he never really found relief from these situations. Two of his sons were killed. A synagogue was burnt down. And there was some interaction between him and Shabtai Tzvi. It's interesting, at the time, Shabtai Tzvi did draw a following. Then later on, people saw that he was a fraud. But again, you see from the beginning to end of his life, he was really living under very, very desperate situations. Okay, so now we have the Shach, Shabtai HaKohen. So if you look at the years that they lived, so the Taz is 36 years older than the Shach. The Taz was born in 1586, and the Shach was born in 1622. But they were contemporaries.
Shach only 41 years.
Right. The Shach was only 41 years old when he died, and he was obviously a prodigy, but there were some, at least when he first came to the scene, who were a little bit thought that it was chutzpahdik, especially because we'll see that the Shach seemed to have had a very strong personality. And here you have this 25-year-old writing writing something that we'll see not only argues with some of his contemporaries, but even argues with the Shulchan Aruch and the Rishonim. And at times the Shach will forcefully present his own opinions. Again, it comes back to the question, can you argue on the Shulchan Aruch? So it seems at least from the immediate aftermath, it wasn't exactly like the Talmud, where it was voted upon and it was unanimously accepted. And there are places where the Shach disagrees with the Shulchan Aruch. say what the Shach sometimes does is not only does he kind of say that everything that everyone was incorrect, but really their support for his position, which seemingly is not like what they some of the Shach will have line up sources disagreeing with them, but then finding a way to use them to support his position. And the Shach, many times probably more times than not in Yeridaya, and particularly in Yeridaya, we generally go like the Shach. So he was, 25 when he published the Shach, Sifsei Kohen. And there's a story that's told about the Shach, certainly after he published his Sefer. So the Shach had a Din Torah, he had a civil dispute with someone else, and before he went to court. So he was making his argument because he thought that the halacha was in favor of his argument. So he, immersed himself in all the sources and came with a prepared argument. Now the Shach is obviously no slouch. And the Dayanim heard his case and they ruled against him. So the Shach objected. He said, his case was so foolproof. He was so sourced in the halacha. How could they rule against him? So the Dayan said, I want to know the basis on which I ruled against you. So he pulls the book off the shelf, the newly published Sifsei Kohen on Choshen Mishpat. And he points to it and he says, see, this is a proof against your case. So the Shach said, now he realizes why, someone is a Karov Etzel Atzmo, that someone isn't really able to objectively evaluate his own case, because he wanted a proof from his Sefer. That's a story that's told. But on Choshen Mishpat and on Yerideya is where the Shach is found on the page. So here's a copy of a standard edition of Yerideya. You have the Shach and the Taz, and in Or HaChaim you have the Taz and the Magen Avraham, the two main commentaries. And there was some, passionate exchange between the Shach and the Taz. The Taz published his commentary in Yerideya in 1646, and then later that year, the Shach also published his commentary. And the Taz was 60 years old, and the Shach was 24. And then there were those who criticized it, but the Shach was very confident in his positions. And number 13, some of it got cut off. But he says that whoever was not in my presence cannot begin to believe the great effort with which I searched in the Sea of the Talbot and Poskim until I established everything upon its foundation. I reviewed every aspect and angle, not once or twice, but 101 times. I labored diligently and not involved myself with other activities, etc. And he goes on to say that if I disagree with the Shulchan Aruch or even some of the Rishonim who came before that, it's based in the Gemara, and I'm confident that my arguments are correct. And just to give an example of that, in number 4, in his commentary, in number 14, his commentary to Choshen Mishpat, even though the words of the Mechaber of Yosef Karo, the Shulchan Aruch, and the Sma, the Meir HaSeinayim, one of the other main commentaries on the page in Choshen Mishpat on financial law, Hey Medivrei HaRabbam, or from the words of the Rabbam, Shekasav Kein LaHedya, that were written explicitly, the Yu HaTorah B'Ktzara, and are also brought in the Torah, Mikol Makom Lo Nehira. Nevertheless, they don't seem to make sense. They're not clear. The Kamaduk De B'Shas Muchach, and in many places in the Gemara, it's clear, basically like what I'm saying. And he was a genius, and again, the Shach has been accepted, but you have someone in their 20s not only arguing with people on the scene right now, but arguing with the Rabbam Torah Shulchan Aruch, so it took him some time to become accepted. And also you see that he had a certain, he was passionate, and may have been misinterpreted or perceived as chutzpah, but there's definitely a style that you see in the shock and the confidence. And he says, like number 15, for example, Chozeh Baruch Hashemesh Mitzarayim. Everything that I'm saying is clear like the sun in the afternoon. Vod Srafti Laharik Rach Shebeis Yosef Amaram. I Charlotte Baal Sefer Lechem Mishnah. Sherry's Yosef, even what I'm saying is so clear, and I don't need to go and answer from the Beis Yosef, the Maram, these Lechem Mishnah, Bach, Lomatzukol Anshe Chayel, Yisidayim, Mekom Akanichu, these Gadar Amir Hashemayim. That basically I'm confident in my proofs and in my position. And, another example, the Pilim Mechaber, Vashar, Achronim, Lo, Okay, Yafe Bekan, that basically they don't really understand it. Then I have to expound upon it. So again, he has a lot of confidence, and just a note, he was very young. And the style is seen different postgame have different styles. Anyways, there even within different communities, there are different traditions and styles in Psak Halacha. For example, Rav Adi Yosef, in particular, and many in the Hungarian tradition, rely heavily on precedent. So in Rav Adi Yosef's Tshuvos, you have, a million sources, and that has a basis in Halacha. Achrei Rabin Lahatos, you go up to the majority, and Rav Adi Yosef will, bolster his argument by demonstrating how many sources and how many previous poskim, agree with this position. So a lot of his arguments are based on precedent and basically, stacking up, not just for the sake of stacking up, but basically stacking up positions that support a particular argument. For Moshe Feinstein, if you look at his shuvas, it's a very, very different style. May quote, a couple of main sources, the Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, Magen Avraham, Taz, Shach, but doesn't quote a whole slew of Achronim, but will oftentimes base his position on an insight into the Gemara. Meaning it's more Svara based. It's more going back and not necessarily accepting all of the precedent, but basing an argument on the on insights into the Gemara, and obviously not contradicting at this point, Shulchan Aruch. But for example, in the introduction to Igros Moshe, he says he may argue with the Chasam Sofer, who came 150 years before, not because he thinks that he's 100 years before, not because he thinks he's greater than him, but if he understands the sugya differently, so he's just ruled differently, and he says that in every generation a person has to, provided he says that it doesn't go against anywhere in Shas. And then Talmud Bavli, because that's absolutely authoritative. So you see, it's a different. So Rabbi Tendler, Moshe's son-in-law, I heard say, has a similar style, in many ways, to the Shach. Of he has an argument, so it may be different than what previous poskim held. But again, it is a different. There are realize in halacha and in different communities, there are different traditions on how to come to psak. And the Taz then wrote to, it was a Daf Achron, I have it here, but in the our copies of Yoreh Day at the end, Daf Achron, the last, basically at the last page is a, letter from the Taz, defending his position and his, arguments with, in particular, with the Shah. He says, "Gam ge'eni kadai lachriyam ikom makom atzar bevilin lo lo chel." Not able to argue on this, and he comes to defend some of the previous the poskim who the Shah had argued on, and. And everyone, he didn't mention the Shach by name, but basically everyone knew who he was referring to. So then the Shach responds with the Kutras Achron. You have the Daf Achron of the Taz, the Kutras Achron of the Shach. And he says in number 20, basically writing things on me, Raki Haskir Shemi, and he's too afraid to mention my name. Ah, move on the call, maybe in the call of Chakasa Vidafa Akron, the call Maj Shatarak, Lotarak Elabishvilin. He knows that he did this all, he wrote this all on my account. And he says that keep bleas suffic, Mishlo Tom year of a Yavin Shakol Dvara payment the Havai, Veloba Ella, the country. Like a fact in the halach was matat tzarek bedika akrav, and he only did this to lekanter to as a way to start up with me. Keep in mind he's 36, he's in his 20s, and the shach is in his 60s. He only did this to start up with me, and they should really check him out, and basically he's confident in his arguments. Then we see later on that the shach seems to tone it down a little bit, and because then he has also
this is the Taz.
The Daf Achron is the Taz. The Kuntres Achron is the shach. And then you have the longer response of the shach to the Taz, also printed in standard, at least nowadays, standard edition of Shulchan Aruch, the Nekudas HaKesef. It's based on the Pasuk, the Turei Zahav, Nekudas HaKesef. And he says there, in number 21, Amar Mechaber, referring to himself, the author, Al Yala Leva Kore B'Sifri, the person who reads this shouldn't think, that I have any argument with the author of the Taz. Oh, yeshlo belibi ezo tina loy, that I have any kind of complaint against him. And Rekhiz Yasagos al Sifroki alo noda lechol mishin is kaim onu as above the sofa Torah. He says peace with him with very complimentary terms, and he says that Shasisi Aksanoi Lebal Torah Zav, that I hosted the Taz via Etzli Shloshi Yomim, and he was at my house for 3 days. He bought it to Kavod Gadol, and I gave him a lot of honor. Asher Lo Yuman Ki Yisupar Vegamhu Niskaved, and I Garbed, and he gave me a lot of Kavod, and basically nothing is personal here. This is all the Shem Shemayim, and this is all in an effort to be mevarer haemes, to discern the truth. So you see that there did develop respect between them, and maybe as time went on, the shach was becoming a little more measured, but the shach had become very very authoritative. It said that. General, that in Germany, the Taz may have been more prominent, but in Lithuania and nowadays, really, I think the general in Derech Imsach is the general tradition we have is in if there is a machlokes, let's say the shach and the Taz, particularly in Yoredeya, generally the halacha will be like the shach. The shach, at the end of the day, did become very very prominent and very influential. Again, it's basically the standard for minimum for smicha. You learn Shulchan Aruch, shach, and taz. Those are essential commentaries. But again, the shach seems to have not to compare. But the history has shown that the shach did seem to become more authoritative. Though there were some, even in the period that followed, there was some discussion or conflict about. Who would become authoritative? Because at that time in Poland and Lithuania, there was the Vlad Arba Ratzos, the Council of the Four Lands, and sometimes they would say, the position is like this or like this. So sometimes it went back and forth that the Shach is the Shach and the Taz, but one of the reasons perhaps that the Shach was accepted is, and the Shach came a little bit later and really accepted the Shulchan Aruch more fully. Because the Bach, the Taz's father-in-law, was a commentary of the Torah and has some disagreements with the method of the Shulchan Aruch. So maybe the Taz was a little bit more partial to the Torah, but the Shach was really a commentary on Shulchan Aruch, and it was part of this whole process of how the Shulchan Aruch became very authoritative. And the Shach was 41 when he died. So a lot was accomplished in a short amount of time under very difficult conditions. Also just in the Shach's personal life, he was also affected by the pogroms, and he composed some of the slichos, and they declared a fast to on the day of Chof Sivan, the massacres of Tachvatat, and that's why, right, particularly Ashkenazi communities, many Ashkenazi communities, in fact, the Ramah quotes that as the main Ashkenazi practice, even though now during Sfira, probably the older Ashkenazi practice was to observe the restrictions of Sfira from Rosh Chodesh Iyar through 3 days before Shavuos. And part of the reason why the emphasis was on the, let's say, second Sfira, as they call it, was because that's where many of the pogroms were. So there was, particularly in Ashkenazim, there was that time contributed not just the Talmidim of Rav Akiva, but also the more current events which occurred during that period. And so you have the Shach, the Taz, and then we get to Orech Chaim. The main commentaries are the Taz and the Magen Avraham. So who was the Magen Avraham? Avraham Gombiner, and he was the youngest, 1634 to 1682. And his parents were murdered by the Cossacks. Again, no one caught a break. And what position did he have? So he was basically a cheder rebbe. He was a kindergarten teacher. And the story goes that the Shach came to the town of Kalish, and he met with some of the students at the school. So he's talking to the students. He says, "Oh, these students are incredible. Who's your rebbe?" So the Rebbe was the Magen Avraham of Gombiner. So basically then he got promoted to be the posek of the town, but he started out as a cheder Rebbe, and was basically discovered by the Shach. And at least the Magen Avraham, his commentary on the Orech Chaim section of Shulchan Aruch was published after he died, so you didn't really see his work published. And it's also, so we've been learning Mishnah Berurah. So many times the Mishnah Berurah quote the Magen Avraham. Magen Avraham was particularly influential in the section of Orech Chaim. Yet famously, you see on the Zmanim charts, calculates the Zmanim as one position to calculate the
early riser.
Shalzmanios. Right, well, it really depends what time of day it is, but he calculates it from Alos HaShachar to Tzeis HaKolchavim, from dawn to nightfall. Supposed to the Vilagon, the Balatanya, calculated from sunrise to sunset. Which is why for Kriya Shmar Tefillah, it'll come out that the Magen Avraham is the earlier time. And many communities were particular about the Magen Avraham. So the Aruch HaShulchan, the Rosh HaVayinstein say, generally in Lithuania, the opinion of the Gra, of the Vilna Gaon, for the Zmanei Hayom, were generally accepted. To say that that's why the basic halacha is that is the Zmanim of the Vilna Gaon. So the Aruch HaShulchan says, Halavai, you should make sure to say Kriya Shema by the Zman of the Gra. But also, his commentary all through Orech Chaim. And just recently, see a similar type of thing, Rav Nota Greenblatt, who lived in Memphis to the end of his life, but was he was very, low key, publicly, but was known to be the biggest expert in Gittin, and was involved in OU Kashrus, and a tremendous Talmud Chacham. And he went to Memphis when he was still not married. He ended up marrying someone from Memphis. And I think he couldn't get the job as rabbi. There was already a rabbi there, so he was like the chazan. He came to be, you know, the cantor of Yom Narayim. And then also he was kind of discovered like this person's, you know, tremendous Talmud Chacham. So these were the three, I think, most important commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, the Tashach and the Magen Avraham. And they see that they lived in under very difficult circumstances. And, you know, you just think about it. You know, one of these, you know, tragedies alone, the tragedy of his children being, you know, killed in the accident with the roof falling, or all everything that was going on with the pogroms, you think, okay, so we'll, you know, take it easy. But obviously they persevered in very difficult times, and their contributions were lasting. And I think this hopefully shows a little bit of the of what the world was like when they lived, what their personalities were. You see that you know, great sages arguing with each other, even passionately, is not something new, but it's also a lesson that there was still the respect between them, and they were arguing L'shem Shemayim, and you see the impact of these three people.
Sure.
Thank you for coming. Have a good night.
Thank you.